Baby, you are gonna go broke showing turkeys like these.
It's turkey time. Gobble, gobble.
Hey, listeners. We are officially kicking off spooky season with this first of 2.5 solid months of horror-themed episodes. So sit back, put your feet up, light that jack-o'-lantern, sip on that hot beverage, and let's jump into some spooky content. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Let's Talk Turkeys. I'm your host, Movie Miss, and I'm being joined this week by my co-host, as always, Drive-In Dave. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Are we excited about this one or not so much?
Okay, I can't say I hate this one.
Okay.
It's not something I'm going to put on if I'm bored and like, oh, I want to watch this movie. It's not one of those, but I don't regret watching it. It was actually like, okay, this isn't too bad. This is kind of interesting.
Okay. Did you consider it like a B movie or just like an A movie not quite done well?
I would say like a B plus, A minus kind of movie. You know, or okay. Like one of those ones, like when you don't even get like a letter grade, you just get like a star sticker on the paper kind of thing.
Pass or fail.
Yeah. Like that's kind of like, you know, like good job movie. That's kind of how I thought. Like they handled it well. It just felt like one of those movies that was direct to video when it came out. Like there's like, I could not have pictured this coming out in the theater. Like that this was obviously a, you know, direct to like, you know, Blockbuster or Videorama or, you know, one of those old video stores.
You'd like to think that, wouldn't you? But no, it was in theaters. So we're talking about 1990s offering to the satanic panic craze, The First Power.
Since the beginning of time, Satan has worked to create the perfect killer, one who kills many without reason, one who cannot be stopped. Today, that man exists. Be warned.
We're just going to go through a very small door here.
Lou Diamond Phillips is hunting a man who kills for the sake of killing. Tracy Griffith might be the only one who can help stop him.
I know where he's going next.
But this location fits the pentagram pattern on the map, and my informant says this is where he's going to strike next.
This is the third time in less than 5 years that Logan has been responsible for the death or capture of a serial killer.
See you around, buddy boy.
I doubt it.
Each death makes him stronger.
How did you know where he was going next?
I opened myself up to him. You might have executed his body, but his spirit has been released.
He has the third power. He could be anywhere.
How's the stomach, buddy boy?
He has the second power.
Hey, cutie.
He could be anyone.
Sister.
Well, I'm afraid she's not here.
Now, he has the first power.
See you around, buddy boy.
Immortality.
You don't have any idea of what you'd be facing. You can't go on killing forever.
You want a bit.
It is a breezy 98-99 minutes. Rotten Tomato critic, it is a turkey, 25%, and then audiences 45. Now, for me, this movie is a love of mine and rewatchable for me every couple years and fun for two things. A, the cast. The cast and the performances suck me in and I get into it and I love it, especially the villain. And also it's nostalgia for me. Because I was like, I think just finishing high school when this came out. And so it was one I saw on home video because it did go to the theaters, but I saw it on home video and then over the years revisited it every, you know, couple years. So it's just a nostalgia thing for me. I think I don't expect everybody who sees it to love it because I know for you, this was a first time watch. So that had to be an interesting experience to watch an old movie like this for the first time.
It was, but I mean, I like movies from the 90s. I like that era, you know, the bad looking, I mean, like to today's standards, the bad looking hair and, you know, the way they dress and stuff like that. I enjoy that because I'm a freaking 90s kid. I love the 90s. But what I'm hearing from this, the way you're describing this, I'm hearing this is your Darkman.
Almost. I don't love this like you love Darkman. I do like this one an awful lot that I do recommend it to people who are looking for, hey, I've seen everything. Can you recommend a scary movie that I might like? And I always preface it with, it's not the best scary movie that you're ever going to see, but it's fun. I promise you, it's at least fun.
It was fun and it went quick. And it was one of those movies that it kind of sucked me in until about the end where I was kind of like checked out a little bit. I wouldn't call it a scary movie though. There was nothing scary about this movie. It was just like, oh, that happened.
So the first Power had a budget of $10 million and it did a box office domestically of 22.4. So it was released in theaters and did fairly well. As long as it doubles its money in my book, I think that's good. But in Hollywood standards, you have to triple your money to break even. I don't know how that math works because, you know, me and math are not friends. So this was filmed in and around Los Angeles, California. They even refer to the names of, you know, all the places there of what they really are. Elysian Park really was filmed in Elysian Park, etc. One interesting thing I thought about this was once we get into the plot, it'll be clear. If you haven't seen this movie, listeners, you'll understand having the first power and what happens with that. They originally titled this movie Transit for the ability to, you know, jump around. What song is that? House of Pain. Shit, I'm old. Okay. Anyway, it was called Transit. That was the working title. That was what they were going to call it. And at the last minute, luckily, the studio said, you know, that kind of sounds like it's a movie about a bus or buses or something. I think we should change the title. And boy, am I glad they did, because that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, Transit, I would have thought like, oh, it's a Speed ripoff or something like that. It does not. Or, you know, a little old lady gets on a bus and it's her journey to go get groceries.
I would watch that, especially if it was a Disney movie. So we've got directed and written by Robert Reznikoff. And the only things I could find, he had written three things prior to this, nothing of note, nothing anybody's probably really ever heard of. And then he only directed a short called The Jogger. Don't know what that's about, but he really didn't have a lot of directing writing. So I kind of want to hold that against this movie because I feel like some of the scenes, and we'll get to them, if they were directed a little bit better, if some of the dialogue had been a little bit better, I might like this movie even more and new people might like it even more.
But it kind of tracks in a sense too, though, for me, because watching it, it felt like one of those movies that it was, this is going to sound insulting, and I don't mean it to be, but it felt like a TV movie. Even the actors, even though like I know who the actors are, and like once I looked them up and I saw like, oh, they were in this, and this, they went on to do like a pretty decent career. There's no huge names in this. They didn't really go on to like do anything like major.
No, I agree with you 100%. And then to pile on to that, it's rated R for the subject matter, but there's not gore and there's hardly any blood or killing really. A couple scenes.
It felt like a beginner film. Like it felt like this was like everyone's first movie, the actors, the producers, the director, the caterer, like everyone in this movie, like this is their first job.
So it in fact was not for everybody because we've got top billed cast of Lou Diamond Phillips, Jeff Kober, Tracy Griffith, and Michael T. Williamson. So I don't know what Michael T. Williamson did before this, but a lot of you will know him as Bubba from Forrest Gump. Man, was I just vibing on that kid and play fade square haircut he has in this. It's so 80s, 90s.
I love how like there's an early scene in the movie where when they're in a car or whatever, and I swear up and down, it looked like they were channeling Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills Cop. He looked so spot on like it. I was like, did they just get like an Eddie Murphy ripoff?
I could totally see that. Did you not realize that was Bubba like right away?
I honestly did not know it until I went and did the research. The funny thing was that when I did the research, I counted at least 5 cast members all came from Hill Street Blues.
That tracks. Probably the detectives and the lieutenants and whatnot.
There's another character I'll point her out when we get to her in the movie, but like there's 5 people, at least 5 people, all Hill Street Blues. And all of them came from like 80s either cop shows or something like that. It's like that's why I felt like this was like a TV movie.
So Jeff Kober is the villain, Patrick Channing. He's still working to this day. He has, to me, the face of a bad guy. I know he plays other roles, but he's been on Sons of Anarchy. He's done tons of horror stuff, Star Trek shows, Buffy he was on. He's an amazing character actor, one of my favorites. Another reason why I probably like to revisit this movie, because I feel like his performance saves this movie for me. He is, for lack of a better word, scary to me. If I encountered this man in real life, I'd shit my pants. Really, he's very scary to me.
I mean, he had a good look. The only reason, the first viewing, that it kind of lost me a little bit on his look is because he looked like a more sane Gary Busey.
I see that. I can see that. And then we also have Tracy Griffith as Tess, the psychic. And I didn't know this until I was doing the research now. So all these years, I never knew this. She is the half-sister of Melanie Griffith.
Damn.
And if you look at her face, Tracy, in this movie, the red hair, I was like, no. But then if you look at her face, I totally can see it.
I might have to go back and rewatch it again. Damn you for making me do that. to kind of look at it. Because, I mean, she did have a look about her. Like, I really liked her. But at the same time, her performance was kind of just there.
And she does not do it for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was kind of like, I felt like she was trying to play the hot girl. And she just wasn't comfortable in the role.
So the last little casting note for now is there, somebody pops up as the bartender. I did not know this until after I was done watching the movie again. So now I'm going to have to go back and watch it for the 150th time. The bartender is the one and only Bill Moseley, Otis from Devil's Rejects and Rob Zombie movies.
Damn it. Now that's another reason I have to go back and rewatch it. Cause yeah, I do love me some Bill Moseley. So
me too. And I didn't even realize. So to note, the ending of this movie was reshot to be more exciting. You can tell, if you know that tidbit, watching the movie, they were like heading one direction. And then all of a sudden they go, we need some more action. So there's this, you know, 20-minute fight scene that goes on and on from room to room. They wanted more excitement. I guess they felt that was the way to go, right? More fist fighting.
And after learning that, I wish we could get like a director's cut or something with the original ending, because I would be curious if that would keep me more entertained. The end really lost it for me. That's where I kind of just pulled out a little bit, because it didn't feel like it was supposed to be in this movie.
How'd you feel about the music in this movie?
The music I liked. And then I saw who did the music. I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Now I understand why.
And who was that?
Stuart Copeland. Obviously, people should know, the drummer and one of the founding members of the Police.
That's right. Again, for me, one of the little things that makes me like this movie, in the scenes where I'm genuinely scared of the villain or his presence, the music sting and the music notes that he's using tell me I should be nervous or tense or scared. And normally in a movie, I don't like that. I don't like to be told by the filmmaker when I should feel scared. I want to just feel it because you did the movie correctly, if that makes sense. But here, I don't mind that they tell me. So as I mentioned, this movie comes kind of on the tail end of this whole big satanic panic craze that was happening in the 80s. The villain is also, and the story are loosely taken from the real life account of Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, who was an active serial killer in 84, 85. They also loosely talk about him and have him in the season 9 of American Horror Story 1984. It has Richard Ramirez in it, which I thought was really fucking cool.
Now, where did you find this at?
So I knew this because I witnessed it. In real life, I was spending the night at a friend's house during one of the years the Night Stalker was active. I think it was in 85, right before he was caught. And he struck like one neighborhood over, I think it was, one night when I was spending the night at my friend's house. And I didn't know this until like decades later. So I had always kind of after that one, after learning that, I was always kind of like, oh, who is this Night Stalker? What happened? Because I was, young at the time. So I've known about him and done my research. And then when he popped up on American Horror Story, I was cracking up. I've seen the knockoff, terrible Night Stalker trying to tell the true story of him movies that have been done over the years. I'm not a big fan of satanic panic type movies. The ones I could come across in my research were The Unholy, The Seventh Sign, The Believers, Trick or Treat, Evil Speak, and Prince of Darkness are all those movies that were kind of jumping on the devil Satan bandwagon in the late 80s. So I've always known about all of this and everything. And the first Power, I think another reason, here we go, on adding to my list of why I like this horrible movie is because of that. It's got that loose tie to the Night Stalker. So
Okay.
now that I've unloaded all of that on you, what do you think?
That's interesting. And that's scary as shit. I mean, it's a good thing you didn't find out about it until like, later on or whatever when you were older. At the time, that stuff is creepy. If like someone breaks into the house next door to me, I'm, panicking. I'm like staying up at like 3 in the morning with the baseball bat staring at the windows and the door, like, come at me, motherfucker. Let's see what happens.
It's so funny you would say that because I have a baseball bat next to my bed. I also have a machete, a taser, and a pocket knife. Ain't nobody getting near me. Unless, of course, they have a gun, then I guess I'm screwed.
Yeah, see, that's the one weapon I don't have. I've got the, like I said, pocket knife, the baseball bat. I don't have a machete, but I have several different styles of sword. Even like one of the like samurai ninja swords and stuff. I've got
Is
one
it
of
sharp?
those. It should be. I've never done anything with it.
All right. IMDb plot for this gem. A dedicated LA police detective and a female psychic must stop a demonic serial killer who was given the powers of resurrection, teleportation, and possession.
They pretty much seem to kind of hit it right on the head.
Yep.
Not much missed on that one. They
All
kind of
right.
give away a couple of things too, though, with the teleportation. It's like, really? I mean, you should have like saved that as a surprise.
Agreed. It kind of ruins it if you know that ahead of time. So, Lou Diamond Phillips, I wanted to mention when I was watching this, I thought, the older I get, is it just me getting older? Is he getting younger? What's happening? But then I looked it up. He was about 27 when he made this. He had just done Young Guns and Young Guns 2. And I was like, wow, was he a baby? He's so young. He looks too young to be this hard-boiled detective, you know?
He doesn't age that I like it's even to this day because he was just recently on a show I was watching on Fox called Prodigal Son,
Yep, I
which
loved him in
was
that.
it was a great show. I'm still pissed off that it's gone, but he was great in it, and he's still like it's like the only reason you can tell he's older is because he's put on a little bit of weight in the face and he's got a little gray in the beard and stuff like that. But you get rid of all that and he still looks 20s.
All right, let's jump in. When the movie starts, we first get the opening theater logos, and I was, or a studio logos, and it's Orion Pictures. And again, with the nostalgia. I'm like, oh, here we go, old movie.
I miss Orion.
So then we get studio credits and a black screen with that really cool, freaky music playing. And then we get cast and opening credits rolling over a slowly forming pentagram on screen. Then the credits conclude with a formed full pentagram. It moves off to one side and we get title card, the first power. And I don't like, I mean, as you know, talking to me, I appreciate credits over movie. Like, let's get moving. This was like 3 solid minutes of just credits on this black screen, basically. And I was like, oh, movie. Clearly just to pad the runtime because it's only 98 minutes.
It was pretty bad. I mean, like I called the pentagram the moment the thing started to kind of like all come on screen. I was like, oh, this is going to be a pentagram. And then exactly when it happened, I was like that. I was like Leonardo DiCaprio in that meme where he's like, oh, pentagram, pentagram, like pointing at the screen.
Called
I
it.
called
I
it.
called it. So we open on Sister Marguerite, a nun reciting scripture from the Book of Revelations to a handful of, I guess, Catholic priests or like the higher ups in the LA chapter of the church. I wasn't real sure.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if they were. I don't know a whole lot about religion. I couldn't tell if they were like Catholic, is when you have bishops and stuff. So I couldn't tell what they were. But yeah, they definitely were old white men with power.
So Sister Marguerite is only in this movie a little bit, kind of at the front and the end, and maybe for a minute in the middle. That's Elizabeth Arlen. And I knew there was a Turkeyverse connection in here somewhere. It's her. She was in European Vacation. So
really,
there you go. There's our connection. She's trying to tell these men that she thinks the recent 15 killings in the country are all linked and they're satanic in nature. And they basically blow her off. They're like, whatever, sister, thanks for your input. Even though she's pointing out the inverted pentagram being carved into the body of the people that have been killed, every single one of them has this in common. They're like, yeah, yeah.
It makes sense, though, because it's like, you know, that's the point of religion, is it's old men basically having power over women, telling them, no, you shut up. We're in charge. This is how this works. And then, yeah. I mean, I didn't trust him anyways, because I saw all the flowers in the background. And my immediate thought was like, so how many altar boys gave those priests those flowers?
They tell her, return to your convent. We don't want to sensationalize devil worship any more than it already is. I will give them credit for that with the whole satanic panic thing. It's like, we don't need any more. So
apparently they don't play D&D.
So we fade now into the apartment of one Russell Logan, and that's Lou Diamond Phillips. He's got an old pizza sitting on the table. His cat is standing there munching away on it, a table full of maps and photos, and he's trying to visibly connect dots with a pattern, and he gets frustrated, and then his phone rings. This is such throwback stuff for me, like the landline phone, the maps, and the old phone. Like, this is a whole different way of detectiving.
This is like right before detectives became, like I said, yeah, you get all the technology and all that kind of crap comes in. This is like when detectives were cool. Like from this point up until like going back to like the 50s and the 30s, those were the cool detectives. Now it's all like, you know, David Caruso and, you know, yelling at a screen and putting on sunglasses slowly and going to technology, you know, conventions and getting the new like equipment and shit. And it's like, we don't care about that. We want maps. We want you smoking a cigarette and drinking black coffee and yelling and smacking around criminals.
So there's a woman on the other end of the phone saying, I know where he's going next. After she describes wounds on the victims, Russell is intrigued and says, basically, okay, I'll bite. What do you know? Because how would she know these things that weren't released to the public, the details? So the woman says, I'll only talk to you if you promise not to kill him or give him the death penalty. And Russell, who has no such authority to make this deal, says he promises. Okay, no death penalty. Okay. What?
He's going to tell her anything she wants because he wants to catch the bad guy. And plus, because I mean, at this point in the movie, I thought he was talking to like a phone sex operator. So I would have said the same thing of like, yeah, baby, you know, I'll tell you anything you want. Just keep me going.
So she says Elysian Park is where the killer will strike next. He hangs up and he marks that park on his map and then conveniently is able to immediately connect the dots to form a pentagram. Normally that would bother me, but for some reason in this movie, I let it go.
I mean, I always like that. It is such a cheesy trope in movies, but I do enjoy that because like, that's what makes these things fun is, oh, okay, it's a pentagram. I don't imagine any criminals actually marking the pentagram on the map and like, I'm going to strike here, 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 and here. It's just so I can make this symbol.
Yeah, you have to wonder if he's looked at a map and thought it out, or if he just, because he's demonic, the killer, you know, he just knows how to make the pentagram, where to strike. I don't know.
Maybe he's getting like Western Union grams from like Satan or something saying, here, go to this address.
So next we get a stakeout / sting thing kind of happening at the park with a female cop, Carmen, as bait.
Sue, I'm going to try to pronounce this, Sue Giosa, Giosa, it's a G-I-O-S-A.
Okay. So she's not in this a lot, but I like her. She was believable to me. Like she's a cop that goes undercover. I totally bought it.
Well, it's because she's got experience because she came from, wait for it, Hill Street Blues.
All right. Then that's why she's so believable. So she's walking as bait. Like I said, this cracked me up so much because this is a movie of its time, filmed in like 89. One of the male cops says over the headset to her, watching your ass is the only thing keeping me awake up here. Because they've been doing this for three nights and been striking out. And I was like, ooh, that's not even a blurry line of sexual harassment. That's like, that's blatant.
No, and this was back when sexual harassment was, you know, like smiled upon, because she just kind of giggled at it. She's like, oh, you.
Right. And that's always the fine line, isn't it? I mean, if the guy's good looking and he's flirting with you and you're like, hee hee, that's funny. Yeah, look at my ass. If he's some grosso that you want nothing to do with, you're like, oh, don't say that shit to me. That's harassment. It's always exactly. Like, does the woman find me attractive or not? Otherwise, this is sexual harassment.
That's exactly what it is. And this is the most unbelievable part, because there's no way she's going to think that guy was attractive. I mean, he looked like he's had, you know, several Jimmy John sandwiches on the roof alone. So it's like, this is not a good looking guy that you want looking at your ass. If it was Lou Diamond Phillips, then she'd be like, oh, Lou.
So we see Russell and his partner, Detective Franklin, and that's Bubba. Okay, I won't call him Bubba. Michael T. Williamson. They're driving around in this car, and he's complaining to Russell that the lady on the phone was clearly setting them up. They've been here three nights. Nothing's happening. So he's kind of whining, being a whiny little bitch about it. I'm like, bro, you're getting paid. So shut up. Do your job.
Plus, you get to drive around in that cool gray shirt and blue cap looking like, you know, Beverly Hills Cop.
Russell says he thinks that Franklin is easily spooked by all this devil occult ooga booga shit. Ooh, you're spooked, right? And that clearly is meant to tell us that Russell himself is a non-believer. He doesn't believe in any of this devil stuff. Not a religious guy. So we cut to Carmen walking near the park. She gets grabbed and the hand puts a cloth over her mouth, and that's all she wrote. We see the hand has a pentagram on it, a little on the nose.
It was a little predictable, but it's like, okay, you know, maybe they want to make sure that, you know, it's okay, you're getting kidnapped by the main villain in this movie and not just some random guy is like, hey, I like that ass too. Let me grab a piece.
Good point, actually. So Russell gets out and talks to two of his, bosses, higher ups, lieutenants or something.
I couldn't tell who those, even later in the movie, I still couldn't really tell who was who with that, like who was in charge and who wasn't. That was confusing to me. Did you get that too?
Yeah, totally. I just assumed they're his bosses.
Okay. So it wasn't just me then. I thought I was just kind of like, I thought the movie slapped me and made me dumb for a second.
So they're just talking about what's going on and three nights and nothing's happened. All of a sudden they get interrupted. Franklin leans out the car and says, hey guys, they lost Carmen. Carmen's gone. So off they go. Cut to this cave looking situation where Carmen is tied down on the ground, surrounded by candles, and the killer is reciting the Lord's Prayer, you know, Our Father who art in heaven, in reverse. Not the full thing in reverse, but like each line he's saying them in the correct order, but he's saying the lines backwards, which I thought was really tricky. And I was impressed because I can't do it. I tried.
And it was clever too, because it's like you always hear like, okay, if you turn a crucifix upside down, that's like a satanic symbol and stuff like that. So I kind of like that they're bringing into like the reverse thing.
Yeah. So he stops and pulls off this creepy, clear old man face, like Halloween mask he's been wearing, which you see everywhere, every Halloween, they're everywhere. I never see anybody wearing one, but I always see them in the stores. Tells her, don't be afraid. The cops, though, outside, we see they're all like trying to find her. And of course, they get to this park and they run inside, and you can see it's this big stone structure. And back inside, the killer's explaining to Carmen what he's doing and why, also for our benefit. Because why are you going to bother with her if you're just going to kill her anyway?
Exactly. I appreciate the fact that the movie was letting us in. Whenever a movie lets you in, that's always a nice thing, because otherwise you're just like, hello, movie, you want to tell us some information here?
So Russell and Franklin split up. Russell goes into this rock enclosure. Now, I did some research, and this was a sort of zoo/park situation. And this was an enclosure for lions that they used to keep the lions in. So I thought that was kind of neat, because if you look at it from the outside, you can kind of tell.
That does make sense now, because I did kind of think this was a weird looking park. Like, why is this there? Now I do get it with the lions. Obviously, the zoo part must have shut down before this was filmed then.
Way before, yeah. So Franklin's passing by and he hears Carmen. He runs inside and the killer has this creepy mask. He's put it on Carmen's face and she starts to cry. And this scene to me It's tense. I don't like it. I don't care for the intimate shot serial killer moments like this. They kind of are a little unnerving for me, even in a B movie, honestly.
They could be a little bit creepy depending on like who the actors are and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, like this worked because this guy looked creepy. You know, if this would have been like Jack Black or something, you would have been like, eh, no.
So just as he opens her blouse, of course, and grabs a knife, he gets interrupted by Franklin, who gets face slammed into the wall as the killer does. He just pushes him and then runs out of the cave. He runs into Russell, who's on his way in. They tumble outside and roll down an embankment and they're brawling. That seems to be all they do this whole movie. Russell and the bad guy, Patrick, just brawling.
They automatically hate each other. Like this is like the kind of fight you expect, like two people fighting over like whether pineapple belongs on pizza or something.
Right. So Russell shoots the killer as he's running away. He loses him. And then he sees a blood trail leading into a warehouse. So this is the first time in the movie where we get this really creepy soundbite of the killer calling at Russell going, piggy, piggy. That freaks me out so bad that just to fuck with me, I haven't told him this, but if my husband was ever hiding in the dark and went, piggy, piggy, I would probably pee. It freaks me out that much.
That would freak me out, but then I'm sure it would probably freak him out too, because, you know, as a man, the one thing you never want to do to your woman is be like, hey, piggy, piggy. That's like the last thing you'd ever like wake up in like a fucking coma or something.
Holy shit, you're so right. You don't ever want to say that word, but in this context and the way he says it, yeah, it totally freaks me out. So Russell's running through the shadows, trying to find him. The hunt continues and he finally does, but his gun is out of bullets. So he throws it. He's frustrated. There's no bullets and just throws his gun. And I love that when that happens in movies, I always have to ask myself, has that ever happened in real life?
I doubt it, especially because, I mean, I would assume a cop would have backup. Like you're going to have somewhere on you, like extra bullets, like an extra clip or something. So it's like, just like, you know, like, oh, I'm out of bullets. So let's just throw the gun. That's going to kill him.
Right? Like, what is that going to do except give him maybe a little bump on the head?
Although I do want to see one day a movie like do that scene and have that actually work. Throwing the gun actually catches the bad guy.
Right? Because you're right. Every time I've ever seen it, it doesn't do anything. I would love for it to work.
I would. Just like the bad guy laughing. I'm like, ha ha, you're out of bullets. And like, ow, shit, there's my nose.
So he's clearly frustrated, which is probably why he threw the gun, because he immediately runs at the villain, top speed, and they go flying out a window, I'm guessing second story, and they're basically okay. When they hit the ground, they're like, meh.
That was a little bit of a kind of an irritating scene, like, okay, this doesn't, like, at least show them hitting something on the way down, like, you know, a trash can or something to kind of break the fall, but it just seems like, no.
They're fine enough that they can get up and start brawling again. And then Russell gets stabbed in the stomach. Cops run up and arrest the killer. And Russell survives this stab to the stomach. So lucky duck.
People had to realize he was going to survive. That's like, you're not going to kill off Baby Lou in the beginning.
Baby Louie. Get him a little bib. So we see a news update that the Pentagram killer has been apprehended, and they update that Detective Russell Logan has been taken off the critical list. Well, I did appreciate that because it seemed like that's pretty serious if you get stabbed in the stomach, from what I understand.
Yeah, because there's a lot of like vital organs there that you puncture it and you can bleed out, or, you know, there's a lot of problems with getting stabbed in the stomach.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a nice little addition. I mean, again, like I said, no one expected him to serve, you know, to die. It would be kind of funny, though. Just be like, oh, surprise.
Right. And then have a new like lead step up. It's the Bubba show. Then Bubba gets to do it. Why? I keep calling him Bubba. Franklin.
It's his most famous role. So you're going to go with Bubba.
So then we see another news report. They mentioned that this is the third time in 5 years that Russell's caught a serial killer. So it's like, for being so young, he's really good at his job. So we got to give him that. So they're on location at the Department of Water and Power, the newscaster. And he's saying that the killer, Patrick Channing, was an employee there. And at first few times I saw this movie, I never realized there's a quick voiceover at the end of that of the newscaster under his breath saying, well, I'm going to stick to bottled water from now on.
I caught that my first time, but I had the captionings on. So I saw it and I was like, that's great.
I thought that was so funny. So then we cut to Detective Logan at the courthouse. He's getting a face-to-face as the police bring a chained and cuffed Patrick Channing up the steps out in front of everybody. The only reason they do this is because we get to have this really cool little interaction. In real life, I don't see this happening. But he says, how's it going, Russ? Is your stomach okay? And he's so fucking cocky. I love it. He's so snarky.
He really did steal the show in this. Like, he was such a good actor playing that creepy, but also kind of witty bad guy. I kind of feel like if this movie had like a little bit more of a better, either a better budget or better marketing team or something, this would have been a bigger movie because of him.
Yeah. So he knows he's probably getting the death penalty. He's actually counting on it, as we find out. And he says to Logan, as if Russell has any control over this, once again, you're not going to let these pussies wimp out on me, are you? Because he wants the death penalty, as we find out. But I'm like, again, Logan, zero control over whether that happens.
Well, to be fair, we don't technically know that. Like, maybe he does have some say. Like, maybe they're just like, hey, Logan, what do you think? Should we kill him? Should we not kill him? It's up to you, buddy. You decide.
Wow, talk about power going to your head, right?
Yeah, and you could just see it, like one of the old Roman emperors, him just like sitting there and then doing like, is it going to be a thumbs up or a thumbs down? What are we going to decide today?
So then we get the first of several, see you around, buddy boy, that he says to Logan. And again, I love it. Every time he says it, I'm like, woo.
This episode is brought to you by Truly Unique Jewelry. You're a one of a kind, so it's unique, spelled Younique. With all of the jewelry options mass-produced for each season, you're left wanting more when it comes to pieces that showcase your individual style. Head over to trulyuniquejewelry.com and scroll through handmade one-of-a-kind options for every budget, with pieces starting under a dollar. Beautiful costume jewelry to fit every age and every budget. Custom orders are also available for no additional charge, and they flat rate ship so you can fill your jewelry box with matching pieces for every outfit in your closet for one shipping fee. From earrings to bracelets to necklaces, even rosaries and combination sets. Cost is no longer a barrier to having the looks that you want that scream uniquely you. Go to the Facebook page for Truly Unique Jewelry for updates and discount information when you follow the page. Feel good about supporting a small business while you're updating and expanding your jewelry collection, adding pieces for every occasion. Visit trulyuniquejewelry.com. And remember, it's unique spelled Younique. And now, back to the show.
All right, so at the station now, Logan, Franklin, and some of these other cops are celebrating that Channing got the death penalty. He gets a call from the psychic woman who simply says she warned him, no death penalty, you broke your promise, and you better stop it before it's too late. And she hangs up before he can say anything. Again, why did she think he had that power? Really? I mean, really?
With her, I'm just assuming she's flirting. You know, maybe she like thinks he does have that kind of power.
So I did a little research because I was curious, because he's going to get the death penalty. He's being executed. It's in whatever year, 89, 90, present day, and it's in California. So I wanted to look up some info. So it turns out in 1893, they started with the death penalty, and it was by hanging. And I was like, oh, that's brutal. But they were doing it.
If I remember right, when I did like research on the hanging stuff, it was like with the gallows, it wasn't the choking. It was like the jerk of the falling would break the neck, and that would be the killing. And then it's like, well, if your neck didn't get broke, well, you're kind of stuck and you're going to choke to death.
I know. It's brutal.
It's messed up.
So then in 1937, well, 40 something years later, they go to the gas chamber. They switch from hanging to gas. Which seems a little more, I don't know, I was going to say humane, but not really, because choking on poison gas doesn't sound fun either, because you're awake.
Yeah, I've never seen how that works. I looked it up, but I would assume it's not like you just go to sleep. It's you're literally going to choke and stop breathing. So that's probably pretty messed up too.
So since the death penalty had been enacted, 709 people had gotten the death penalty in California. And then it dropped way down in 1976. So from 76 to 06, 2006, only 13 people were executed in that giant span. Damn, so they've got hundreds and hundreds of people on death row, but not actually executing them. A lot of them commit suicide. There's a big suicide rate for death row people. And then last thing I wanted to note, and this falls within that, the 76 to 2006, this execution of Patrick Channing, fictitious, but it would fall within that. So I was like, okay, that tracks. It would be in this time range. They were killing people on death row. He was an egregious serial killer, over 15 people. It makes sense that he would get the death penalty. Also, they do him by gas chamber. Again, that's what they were using. I just wanted to make sure basically that it all lined up. You know what I mean? So it wasn't completely ridiculous.
I kind of wondered about that because I thought at this time they would have been doing the injections, the lethal injection.
That started in 1993 is when lethal injection was introduced.
Okay. Because I only know like three ways with the executions, well, aside from like the hanging, which, you know, we don't count anymore, which was the gas chamber, lethal injection, and then the electric chair, which I don't even know if that's still being used anymore.
That wasn't something they were doing in California. So like I said, yeah, lethal injection came after this. So this having Channing in the gas chamber totally tracks for this movie. And then one last little note, California since 2006 has not executed anybody. That was part of this article that I found. And this article is a little bit older, so I don't know if that's true to this day that we're recording. But that was something that they threw in there. They were like, in California hasn't executed anybody since 2006. I was like, really?
Oh.
Gotten real soft on that. From that's 700 and something people down to zero.
All I can say about that is, you're welcome, listeners. Remember, when you're looking for education on execution, you come to Let's Talk Turkeys.
All right. I guess I should have prefaced that. The whole reason I wanted to talk about that is because I wanted to know if this was all legit, because in the movie, as you know, we'll get to it in a sec, it's ridiculous what happens. But I thought, God, really? Would all this really play out like that with the execution? And it would have, totally tracks.
That's kind of cool. Because a lot of times in cop movies, I mean, like, well, up until this point, like I said, throwing the gun, even just firing the gun the way that he did, that's not proper police procedure. Like, they wouldn't just do that. So that's kind of cool that they actually threw in like some, you know, like, oh yeah, okay, gas chamber, this is how it works.
So we cut to execution day. Channing is all smiles as he's getting strapped into the gas chamber. We've got Logan, Franklin, and a few other people looking on. Channing and Logan stare each other down as the gas starts to fill the chamber. Now, he is excited about this, so he's taking deep breaths, and he's really breathing that gas in and loving it.
He's sucking it in like Cindy Crawford just farted in that room or something.
It's bananas. He's just like having the best time. Music starts to kick up, ominous, spooky stuff, and then we see the room getting cleared of the gas, and the music stops. Channing's head is drooped down to his chest. So we assume he's dead and that this execution has gone through. But then Channing starts to twitch. He comes to, breaks his restraints, magically has a knife. And you're like, what the fuck is happening right now? And then we get a horrible 2 seconds shot, which was 2 seconds too long, of the stuntman busting through the glass. Supposed to be Channing. Dude looks nothing like him, not even close. did you notice that?
I didn't catch that one. I caught the two other things that happened in the movie, but that one I missed. I need to go back and check it out.
It's horribly egregious. It's like, that is not him. What is happening right now? So he busts through. Logan grabs his gun. Everyone's screaming. Logan shoots at Channing and nothing is happening as he's walking up to him. All of a sudden, Logan pops up in bed. And we get a double jump scare because right after he pops up, all of a sudden his cat, Jack, jumps down onto his lap and goes rear and like scares us. Where was that cat?
That was payback, though, because earlier when he threw the paper at Jack when he's eating the pizza and, like, you know, the cat runs off yelling, that was Jack getting payback. They're like, hey, motherfucker, I was enjoying some pepperoni and some cheese, and you just told me no. I was like, no, I'm going to jump on your nuts now when you're asleep.
And I was like, where the fuck was that cat that he fell right on his lap from 8 feet up? Like, what the hell? Also, answer me this. I'm a dog person, so I can tell you every single thing that dogs should not eat, that it's bad for their digestive system or poisonous to them or whatever. You're a cat person. Do you know, can cats eat pizza? Should cats have dairy and pepperoni and stuff like that? Is that fine? Well,
they can have dairy because you give them milk, so they drink milk. But I mean, yeah, I would assume cheese and pizza and stuff like that. Yeah, you're not supposed to give it to them. I mean, it's like any animal. You're not supposed to give them human food, except for, like, you know, tuna or something like that. They do it all the time. My cat used to drink, you know, like after I'd have ice cream, and then they're like the bowl of the melted ice cream, I'd give him that and let him lick it up.
So after that, the cat, Jack, hisses and starts acting strange. Logan grabs his gun, which is right on the night table next to him, right by his head, out in the open and loaded, like ready to go. I thought, what? I get it that you want to have it at the ready for, like, a break-in or something. But what if, and I'm just saying, because I watch Criminal Minds, you're a hard sleeper. He's sleeping middle of the night and somebody creeps in and just picks up your gun off the night table right there and shoots you in the head when you're sleeping. That does not seem smart.
No, it's not. And it's even worse because we've just established he's got a moody cat. So if that cat's not getting fed properly in the morning, it could just, like, walk up, grab the gun and be like, bitch, you're going to feed me or I'm going to shoot you in the ass. So
accidentally steps on the trigger, you know.
And it's kind of like, I don't know enough about guns, so I know I'm going to get shit for this, but it's like, well, like, what if he, like, he forgets to put the safety on or something and he, like, hits the nightstand and the gun, like, you know, just goes off or something in the middle of the night?
Yeah, I don't know the full logistics of that happening or not, but that crossed my mind, like all the unsafe possibilities of just keeping a loaded weapon right next to your head out in the open.
I mean, I'll give it credit. It's better than those people that, like, oh, I sleep with a loaded gun under my pillow. It's like, okay, so basically you're saying that one of these nights you're going to shoot yourself in the head by accident.
I don't get that at all. So he hears a woman screaming from down the hall. In his apartment, he goes down, kicks his door open to his office, and sees blood smeared all over the walls. And it's accentuated by ominous music and then the sounds of, like, flies buzzing or something, like bugs.
Okay,
and
that's what, like, that was.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's gotta smell horrible. But just then, he gets a knock at his front door. We see two uniformed officers. The only reason these officers were sent physically to his house to pick him up was because they wanted this scene for him to be able to go, you guys got to come here. You got to call CSI and check this out. And they bust in the room to show them and there's nothing there. And he looks like an asshole because they're like, okay, the room's totally clean.
The way that it was, like, no, it was, like, so nonchalant with them just being like, okay, we got to go. We're supposed to, almost kind of came off like they're used to him being an asshole. Like, this is not a new thing for them.
Right?
Like, yeah, Logan, you're an asshole. We get it. Okay.
Logan now arrives at the same cave as before. We see Carmen was brought back here and killed, and there's a pentagram carved on her chest.
I actually appreciated that this is, like, the only time we saw nudity in this movie, and it was for a dead body. And I know that's going to sound creepy, and I'm sorry. Let me explain myself.
Well, some listeners know you don't need gratuitous nudity in your films. It has to have a purpose.
It's like, I like that because it's like, I thought for sure it was going to be when he was going to kill her. It was like, oh, we're going to cut the bra off and then we're going to see her tits and be like, oh, something sexual is going to happen with the murder. I like that it wasn't like that. It's like, no, we're seeing a dead body. She's dead. It makes sense to have her tits out.
So next we see a lady in a parking garage pull a dick move and cut a guy off for his parking spot. I hate that. She has a vision when she gets out of her car of Channing coming for her. Ominous music. He's dressed all in black. All of a sudden, like, the parking garage is empty. All the cars are gone. And it's just them. And then all of a sudden, a man scares her because he snaps her out of her vision or whatever she's having when she almost gets hit by a car. because she's just standing there.
Which is funny because the most unrealistic thing out of that entire scene was the fact that the guy who got cut off only said, "Go to hell, lady." It's like, no, it would have been a lot worse than that. It would have been like, "Hey, fuck you, bitch. I'm going to get out there." I mean, it would have been horrible.
Especially in LA.
Exactly.
So we cut to this woman at the police station now, where she's asked to speak only to Detective Logan regarding Carmen's death. He introduces himself and the woman says she is Tess Seaton. She's the psychic who's been calling him. She reminded me, even though I said, if you stare at her long enough, you'll see that she's Melanie Griffith's half-sister. But she reminded me at first of Deborah Foreman from April Fool's Day and a lot of those movies in the 80s, especially with the poofy red hair that she has in this movie.
The only thing I kept thinking of, and I literally do not mean this as an insult because, okay, she's a beautiful woman. This is like one of the few redheaded women I was not attracted to.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's because she's super pasty and has horrible, crimpy, poofy hair from the 80s.
Maybe it was the hair. The pasty thing doesn't bother me.
Oh, okay.
I've also got a thing for goth chicks. So.
Well, there's a difference between painting your face white and just being like, you need some vitamin D, bitch. So she tells Logan that he broke his promise to her about the death penalty. And now Patrick Channing's spirit is free. And he is the one that killed Carmen. So Logan doesn't believe her, of course, because ooh, ooga booga spirit stuff. And he saw Channing die.
That's kind of the thing I thought was like the way she said like, oh, well, I'm a psychic. It made me think like, okay, these cops are not going to respect you anymore because you're a psychic. If anything, saying that's going to be like, oh, she's crazy.
Yeah, she does try to pull the card of I did help police find missing children. So I'm legit. But that doesn't prove the legitimacy to me. I'm still skeptical.
You have to like really prove something, especially to the police. Like, okay, this psychic thing is real. And even then, I think a lot of them are skeptical, thinking, well, maybe you had something to do with it.
So right. Why else would you know?
Yeah.
So she adds that she knows where he's going to go next because she's opened herself up to him. To Channing, and she knows, you know, we know that from the vision that he's got a connection with her.
Am I the only one that when she said immediately said I opened myself up to him immediately said giggity?
I know some of the wording is like, oh, choose a better yeah, way to say that.
There's quite a few times where I was like, okay, is this going to turn into a porno?
The first plower.
All right, you finally got me on one.
And that's just off the top of my head. Give me a minute. I'll come up with some more. So what I do like, though, is that Logan, being his snarky little skeptical self, when she's revealing about being a psychic, he goes, oh, I suppose that's how you got my phone number. And I like that she immediately claps back with, no, I have a friend that works for the phone company.
That was one of my favorite lines. It just like it shut him down like, oh, okay.
Exactly. I expected her to be like, no, I have the yellow pages. And for all you young listeners out there, the yellow pages are that big book where serial killers could find out your name, your address, and your phone number all in one convenient place for your city or township. Yeah. Not a fan of the yellow pages at all.
I was because me and my friends used to do prank phone calls all the time.
Oh my God. What's the best prank call you did? I have like two that come to mind.
We weren't good at it. We were not. We did the typical prank phone calls and stuff. We were not like good, like, you know, is your refrigerator running and shit. Like, it was that. We didn't do anything like fantastic.
You didn't try to do like Jerky Boys stuff?
No, because we didn't listen to the Jerky Boys until later. And then by the time we did, we were getting in trouble for shit as it was. So we didn't want to get in more trouble.
So I was the ringleader. My siblings were younger. My cousins were younger. And we would all get together and do prank calls when we were bored on the landline after having some pizza and watching movies and being crazy at like midnight, you know, on a Saturday, unbeknownst to my parents. So one of my favorite ones was to call people. And when they would answer the phone, they'd be groggy, which was the point. So they wouldn't know what I was saying. And we would say, Visine, this is Red Eye. I need you. Coordinates. Visine, this is Red Eye. I need you. And they'd be like, what? Who is this? What? And we'd have to say it like three times for them to understand what we were saying. And we'd be giggling and you could hear everybody giggling in the background. when the one person was doing it and it would ruin it. So you'd get pissed and slam the phone down. I always felt so bad for those people years later, like fucking pranking them and then slamming that damn receiver in your ear was really harsh.
It hurt. I had the phone like slammed on me a couple of times. Well, I've had several things slammed on me several times. So.
The first plower. So my other story is my cousin, he's a year younger than me. And we were real young, like, I don't know, 13-ish. And he would call people and he would get this real gravelly voice and he'd go, "I'm the Boston Strangler." And we're like, "What? I don't think the Boston Strangler called people." And we'd all start giggling and then he'd have to hang up pissed off because he couldn't keep talking because then he'd start laughing too. We were like so, I mean, didn't everybody are, well, you're a little younger than me, but that era of 80s and early 90s, we were all just fucking thought prank calls were the funniest fucking thing.
You did a lot of shit that was funny back then, and today they would get pissed off at you, but it was a lot of fun.
It doesn't work the same with technology now.
I mean, like, you can do, like, you know, anonymous text messages, and sometimes you can luck out and get something good, you know, like, ask, like, for some girl, and if it's the boyfriend, and they're like, "Well, I'm her man," be like, "Well, when she gets out of the shower, tell her other man called." You know, you could do shit like that.
Oh, my God.
I saw one where they said, like, "Oh, I guess that makes us dick cousins."
Ew. All right. So she mentions to Logan, she's scared Channing is after both of them now. She gives him her card and leaves. And then Logan assigns this other cop to tail her. So follow her. She's up to something is what Logan's thinking. Not that she's a psychic. So in the meantime, we see the guy who killed Carmen is in a cell being yelled at by another cop. I'm guessing this is one of Logan's superiors, this same guy.
Yeah, I still couldn't figure out who these people were.
I was just labeling them in my notes like cop A, cop B, cop C, cop stash.
Yeah,
like
I was going to say you had to go with cop stash and cop no stash because you couldn't even go bald cop and other cop because they were both bald as shit. So.
Another cop tells Logan and Franklin that this man is clearly catatonic and it's just this little guy, looks like this little skinny, like homeless guy just sitting there staring off into nothing.
Looked like David Spade.
Well, they say this guy's probably a junkie, probably homeless, and he had the murder weapon on him from Carmen. I remember Carmen. I don't see this guy overpowering her, but okay.
Yeah, like that guy probably couldn't overpower a Big Mac.
No, no. So Logan goes in, and when he has his back turned to the man, we hear Channing's voice say, "See you around, buddy boy." I love that because then you're like, what is Logan going to buy into this? Like, yet, like, you, that's undeniably his voice. So Logan and Franklin now have a chat. Logan says that guy doesn't look like he could kill anybody. He's also finding coincidence in the fact that Tess showed up today, the same day they catch the killer. So he thinks this whole thing is a setup. He's not buying it. He takes off, him and Franklin, to go find Tess at her home. She lives up in the hills. She does pretty damn well for herself. Her house has a view of the gods. It's got a pool. Bitch does good as a psychic.
It is not a very believable psychic. Like I said, maybe as a phone call sex worker or a hooker, I can see it, but not a psychic.
So they break in to her outdoor gate. They just let themselves in. Franklin points out they don't have a warrant. What are you doing, Logan? Logan says, "Oh, we'll just tell the judge we had a psychic hunch." Pretty sure that's not going to fly.
No, but I love their banter, though. I love like back and forth. Like, those two worked so well together.
Agreed. I felt like they were partners for sure.
Yeah, they definitely were believable as partners.
So they just waltz into her home now. Logan starts poking around her desk, looking on her computer, going through files, finds a horoscope chart with his name on it. Franklin jokes that Tess might have a voodoo love doll of Logan around there somewhere.
And that's exactly why you don't go snooping around a woman's room or house or anything, because you don't know what you're going to find. You might actually find that voodoo love doll, you know, that plugs into the wall and vibrates at like high speeds.
So the cop that's following Tess is doing a lousy job because she's in a shop and he's literally 5 feet away from her, standing right outside the door. He's not very good at being covert.
No, but this bothered me for two reasons. Because one, like, yeah, he sucked at it. But for a woman that's supposed to be psychic and she did not see that they were going to have a cop follow her or like know where the cop was going to be, it's like, you're not proving yourself as a psychic right now, lady.
Okay. I'm not psychic, nor have I ever claimed to be. And I don't know anybody who is. However, I always find it annoying in TV and movies when the big joke is, I'm a psychic, and somebody says, well, why didn't you see that coming? It's like, okay. Look, first of all, I'm not that kind of psychic. Just because you're a psychic doesn't mean that you can know everything all the time, everywhere. She clearly hones her ability.
But, and I would agree. The first time viewing it, yes, I agree. My problem is because the second time viewing it, she says something later or something is brought up later that makes it seem like, okay, no, she knows shit before it happens.
Okay. We'll get there. So now he's just standing there outside the shop while she's getting whatever. She comes out the door and starts walking. He loses her and then all of a sudden turns around and she's right there and confronts him. And I'm like, bro, you had one job. One job.
He really did suck at his job. But then, I mean, it makes sense because he was the guy that was on the roof that was staring at Carmen's ass. So I'm assuming that walking around in LA, and this looks like this was during the summer, there's a lot of ass to be looked at along the way following this woman. So, I mean, on an ass to ass ratio here, we're talking like, you know, cheeks galore. He's going to get distracted. He's going to miss shit.
That tracks, actually. Lots of ass to look at. So back at Tess's place, Logan plays messages on her answering machine, and it's blinking the number 3, that there's 3 messages. The first one is some lady who wants to set up an appointment for a reading. Then a man calls saying that he's canceling Friday night because he can't date a woman who knows what he's thinking before he does. It's too spooky. He calls her spooky.
That's what the second viewing around, that's where, like I said, it bothered me with the cop. Where, okay, so she knows what her date is going to be doing or going to say, but she can't figure out this cop.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And rather, this is not the only time we're going to hear this. This is the first time somebody calls her spooky, but it happens again later. And you're right. That actually tracks with she would know other things.
Boom. Finally, my logic kicks in.
So last, the third message is Channing saying the score is Pentagram 16 LAPD 1. And he asks Russ to meet him across from the church at Alvera Street and calls him Buddy Boy.
I do have to appreciate the fact that they did not go for the obvious stupid satanic joke of like, you know, like, oh, it's Channing 13 or Channing 666, you know, like throwing some kind of demonic number. I'm glad they didn't do that because that just would have made me roll my eyes and be like, oh, come on, movie.
So they get startled because Tess arrives home and catches them in there. And she does say, you're going through my things. You can't do that. She's not wrong. They should not be there going through her things. Shame on them. And then I like how Logan just responds all cocky. I can do anything I damn well want. No, sir. I'm pretty sure you can't and expect to keep your job.
Okay, I want to agree with that, but we are talking about the LAPD.
So he tries to play the messages back for Tess and Franklin, but shocker, it only says 2 on the machine and the one from Channing isn't there. Logan says he heard it. He heard Channing's voice. Franklin looks at him weird and says, someone imitating Channing's voice, you mean? Tess goes, oh, it was Channing. Logan says to her, no more horse shit. He's fed up. And I crack up at that more than I should, because in a movie or TV or even in real life, I've never heard people say the phrase horse shit. It's always like bullshit, dog shit even. I've never heard somebody say horse shit until I met Mike, my husband. His favorite phrase is, that's horse shit. Or what is all this horse shit? And I've never heard somebody say that word as much in my life until I met him. And then I forgot that it was in this movie and I crack up now. Because it used to not be real life to me. And now it's real life because Mike says it all the time.
That's actually a damn good point. I can't remember like ever hearing anyone say horse shit. My mom might have said it once, but I don't know. I can't think of anyone that's ever said it. But that is hilarious. It's like, yes.
Yeah. So Logan manhandles Tess, adding insult to injury for the breaking and entering and snooping through her shit. Now he's grabbing her and yanking her off. We're going. And he drags her out, saying that she's telling him Channing probably possessed the guy that killed Carmen. So he assumes she's in on it and we're going to Alvera Street because that's where the machine said to go. And this is just nuts to me. Like, how is Franklin, who seems to be the level-headed one, letting Logan do any of this? He's just flown off the handle, in my opinion, at this point.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like at some point, like one of the other cops would have been like, you're off the case. We got to drop you. You know, go get some psychological help or something.
Well, Franklin intervenes for a split second, and Tess gets a good look at the St. Christopher medal that he wears around his neck, and it turns into a pentagram. It looks like a pentagram to her, and we get a music sting, and she just says, really deadpan and creepy, that he's in danger. And all I could think was, Molly, you in danger, girl. From Ghost. Bubba, you in danger, son.
The only thing that would have been better is if like there would have been some kind of shrimp reference in this movie.
So they head out, like I said, to go to Alvera Street. I had to look this up because when I was young, I was born and raised in Southern California, and our school class took a trip to Alvera Street. And so I remember it. And this movie, again, probably the nostalgia factor, because I go, oh, I remember being there and doing that, you know, so it's kind of a memory for me. Since the 1930s, it's been a celebration of El Pueblo in LA with historic monuments, a parade. There's merchants, food carts, live animals, street music. People are dressed in authentic Mexican garb. And it's this year-long thing, but certain times of the year, it becomes a bigger deal, like a big festival. And it's just a really cool, authentic, you know, Mexican heritage type of place and the feel, and it's outdoors and it's sunny, and I don't know, there's just something about it. It was just a lot of fun. I remember
it looked like a lot of fun. I mean, I even put that in my notes. That seemed like the kind of place I would like to visit, because it looked like, you know, I love authentic like Mexican food, like the actual street tacos and stuff. That is so fucking good.
So Tess says she knows Channing is there. As soon as they get out of the car, she can feel it. Franklin pulls Logan aside and says he's spooked, and Tess is spooky. So there's two more times that she gets called that. They split up to look around, and then we see there's a man on a horse-drawn carriage situation. He starts storming through the crowd, makes a beeline right for Franklin, knocks him down, and instead of rolling out of the way, he just lays there and lets this horse rear up and buck up on its hind legs and come down and stomp his front legs on his stomach and chest like three times, just proceeds to stomp on him. No one intervenes. There's a crowd. He doesn't roll out of the way. He just lays there and lets this horse stomp on him. And I'm like, really, bro?
It was a shitty death because of that, because it's like it made no sense. Like, there's all kinds of ways this could have been averted. I mean, like, it even kind of looked like he had time to maybe kind of get out of the way of the horse before it bumped into him. But I do have to say, it was kind of cool to see for the first time a horse actually pummel somebody. Most movies do not show that. They, you know, like they'll show the hooves coming down, or they'll show the expression on the guy's face or whatever. You never actually see the horse come down on the body. That was kind of cool, actually. I dug that. So I was like, oh, way to go, horse.
So Logan and Tess run over, and Logan fires his gun up into the crowd, up into the sky, even though there's a crowd right there, I guess to spook the horse and clear the crowd, maybe. He just fires off his weapon willy-nilly.
That one kind of, like, now that I think about it, seems kind of dumb too, because if you spook the horse, isn't it just going to like continue to stomp even more? Isn't it just going to be like, oh shit, I'm spooked, and just going to gallop on top of him some more?
Yeah, I would think. So instead of yelling, call 911 immediately. No. Logan leans down to Franklin and says, He saw Franklin says, I saw Channing. It was him driving that carriage. Blood spurts out his mouth and he looks like he's dying. Logan jumps up and now says, call an ambulance, and runs off.
Well,
I would hope somebody called it already.
I would hope so too, but I think the reason he didn't say it immediately is because I'm pretty sure it's an unwritten rule with all cops, especially like, you know, detectives. You have to go to your partner before he dies in case he accidentally says, damn, 3 more days to retirement. It's like a standard rule.
So we cut to Tess and Logan getting in his car, making chase behind this horse-drawn carriage. Down the public streets now. They've gotten out of Alvera and on the street in traffic. They end at an abandoned warehouse. Logan reaches over, and I'm assuming Tess is cuffed behind her back because you can't really see her arms. And he straps her in by her seatbelt and locks her in the car. It's so weird. And he's like, don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. And it's like, what?
I mean, she was handcuffed. I did see the hands were behind her back, so she was handcuffed. Why do you need to strap her in? She's not going to get out with the handcuffs.
Yes, and I wish we could have seen it. Now, knowing that she was cuffed behind her back, that is my one beef that Mike, every time he points it out to me when we're watching something, you never cuff a perp in the front. Why would you do that? He always says, in this movie, yeah. It's her. She's not going to do anything, but he cuffed her in the back, so good job. So inside, Logan goes in. He sees Channing several stories up in the stairwell, and we get this echoing sound of Channing going, Piggy. I was like, ooh, that's so creepy. And this stairwell to me, too, was giving me like mad American Psycho vibes. I was waiting for him to like drop a chainsaw down onto Logan.
It gave me a lot of vibes. Like they do these kind of stairwells a lot in movies. Ghostbusters has it. The Crow has it. I just recently, like a couple months ago, watched Vertigo for the first time. That's got, it's like these winding stairs and that shot where they look up at the winding stairs and someone looks over. That happens so many times in movies.
Yep. Oh, The Relic recently had one. So Logan gets to the roof and corners Channing right at the edge. And we see that it's Channing now, and he's standing there. Logan is genuinely surprised that he is looking at Channing, and he just goes, see you around, buddy boy. And then we get a really, this is the one thing this movie does right. They do it like 4 times, I want to say, a stunt fall from high above. He falls off this fucking, jumps off this building, right? It's like a 9-10 story building. We get to see the long shot of the stuntman jumping off the fucking roof. And the way that he shoots this and directs this, you see him land like superhero landing on the street. He's perfectly fine and he runs away. I watch that always. I back it up and watch it a couple times whenever I'm watching the movie because it's just a fucking cool shot.
I didn't see it coming. The first time watching it, I expected the splat. I was like, okay, well, the body's obviously expendable. So I thought he was going to fall, kill the body, and then just move on to another body. So I did not expect the landing. And it was so fucking cool that I don't even mind seeing the wire from the stuntman. Like, you can see it, and you're just like, it doesn't matter. That scene is so great. You can forgive it.
So then Logan makes his way down, of course, and the guy's long gone. Police all show up. Logan tells them what happened. They notice Tess is now gone. And when Logan asks, where's Tess? He's informed that her lawyer came to pick her up and they were overheard discussing the size of the lawsuit they're going to bring to Logan for illegally entering her home, abducting her, and endangering her life. Thank you.
My only issue with that was I was curious, how did the lawyer get there? Because it didn't seem like a huge time gap. So did the cops immediately show up and then call the lawyer, and then the lawyer went through LA traffic? And because this all seems to happen in about like a 30-40 minute period,
right?
That kind of, yeah, that kind of threw me off a little bit. Like now I'm channeling you and like figuring out the timestamp. Like, wait a second, movie, this time doesn't add right.
So next we see that the cop that had been following Tess has been killed. His body is strung up under a freeway overpass. One cop points out the obvious by asking, how did they get him up there? Because it's like way the fuck up under this overpass. We see he has a pentagram carved on his chest. And this is where, after all this is happening and the cops are, you know, there and talking, Logan gets taken off the case. He comments, though, I hope I'm going nuts because, you know, this is ridiculous. So I really hope it's just a case of me being nuts. I hope you're right. And he gets taken off the case. Rightly so, honestly.
Yeah, no, that kind of makes sense because like he's starting to hallucinate and stuff. I think this is where I started to get even more confused because the cop that gets put on the case, which I believe Lieutenant Grimes, who was Carmen Argenzino?
Right.
Sorry if I'm butchering your name, buddy. again, from the great Hill Street Blues. But it's like there was a couple times where it felt like he was a superior, but then the other guy who was...
So we also had Commander Perkins, played by Dennis Lipscomb.
Yes, him, because he's named after, the character's named after Alfred Hitchcock and Anthony Perkins.
Oh, that's cool. He's probably the boss because Lieutenant Grimes and Lieutenant Logan, they sound like they'd be at the same level.
Yeah, so I think it's like the further the movie goes, you start to kind of see it. But it's like for a while there, I thought Grimes was the boss because the way he was kind of treating
me too,
Logan and stuff. And so it kind of threw me off.
So yeah, so Grimes gets put on the case now. All right, listeners, that is going to wrap up part one of our coverage on our first offering in this spooky season, the movie The First Power. If you're interested in checking out this movie for a first-time watch or just to bone up in between episodes, it's free on Tubi right now, and or at least at the time of this recording, and pay streaming on Amazon Prime. Make sure to type it in correctly so that you look up The First Power and not The First Plower. Be sure to come back next week for part two of the discussion of The First Power, where we wrap all this up. And until next time, goodbye.
Piggy, piggy.
See you around, buddy boy.
I doubt it.
Hey, listeners, Drive-In Dave here saying we know you have a lot of options when it comes to podcasts, so we want to thank you so much for listening to ours. Please be sure to follow us on all your social media platforms. Join us in the Bad Movie Conversation. We're on Facebook with a Let's Talk Turkeys page, as well as a discussion group where you can chat with other people who also love bad movies. We're also on Instagram at Let's Talk Turkeys, all one word, plus we're on Twitter with the handle at Gobble Podcast. That's GOBBLEPODCAST. And of course, you can always email us direct at Let's Talk Turkeys, all one word, at yahoo.com.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.